Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody thinks we're on the mother. Who are they to judge us? Mother, mother, simply call the sweet where I hello. Mother, mother, ooh,
Welcome, welcome, welcome. You are live on Tribe Family Channel, tuned into A Look Back in Time with Bernard N. Lee, Jr. He is an author and a military kid, and he is qualified to tell us and take us back into time. Let me tell you a little bit about Bernard N. Lee, Jr. as you get prepared to partake in part two of this three-part series. The author of A Look Back in Time, Bernard E. Lee, Jr., is the oldest son of a career veteran of the U.S. Army. Together with his two sisters, Bernadine and Almanetta, and his brother, Mercer, he traveled throughout the United States and Europe during his childhood. The places he traveled, the people he met, and the stories he remembers are shared in this sequel to his memoir. These stories of a military kid in the 50s took place during his dad's three-year tour of duty in the U.S. Army in Germany. Now, can you imagine being a military kid in the 50s and part of the 60s? Because obviously we made it here to 2018, and can you imagine the landscape of that era as it relates to brown and black folk? You can look at the landscape of this era and reflect on the opening song, Inner City Blues by Marvin Gaye. And it really feels like either not much has changed or they are certainly insistent on turning back the hands of time. The current landscape, it begs for your attention. To turn your attention now to Mr. Bernard N. Lee, Jr. for A Look Back in Time here live on Tribe Family Channel. Welcome, Bernard.
Well, thank you very much, Beverly. I appreciate being a guest on Tribe Family Channel. I thank you for inviting me, and I look forward to sharing with you the stories that I collected during the tours of duty of my father as a military son during the 50s. I'd like to read you a poem that I wrote before I started this second book in my memoir series. If you knew your light was dimming, but had memories left to share, would you take the time to write them, or wonder who would care? If you found your past was fading and your present fleeting too, would you capture it for those you love, as I have tried to do? I have lived in many places. I have traveled far and wide, serving God beside my country with honor and with pride. I was here for precious moments. Very soon I will be gone, so I choose to share my memories, knowing they will linger on. That poem expresses my approach to writing my memoir. I wanted to share stories from my childhood and from growing up as a military kid in the 50s and 60s with my grandchildren, my godchildren, and I wanted to be sure that they knew how it was for a person like myself, my dad, my mom, and my sister and brothers during that time. I remember walking along the railroad tracks near Grandma Mitchell's farm in Big Island, Virginia, when I was 5 years old, and wishing I could follow them to faraway places. No one has ever lived near railroad tracks ever forgets that feeling. Now, as I look back in time, that feeling is still there. So are the memories of all the places I traveled as a military kid in the service with my dad. Of all those memories, none is more vivid than the 3 years we spent together as a military family in the late 1950s in Germany. It was a magical time to be a kid and living in a faraway place, experiencing the life and culture of Deutschland. The places we traveled, the people we met, and the stories I remembered are shared in this memoir. On our day of departure, I was really excited. We were going to board a large transport plane that was going to take us to our next station in Frankfurt Airport in Germany. I had never flown before, so I was unprepared for the intense roar of the engines of the plane. The plane lumbered down the taxiway. When we reached our takeoff point, the plane turned gently to the right onto the runway, which ended just before the water's edge. I think we were at LaGuardia Airport. It's a fairly short airport, fairly short runway. I was equally unprepared for the sudden shaking of the aircraft. It was an unsettling experience for me. The plane shook as if a windstorm was buffeting it. The giant wheels rumbled down the runway, causing the plane to vibrate. The combination of noise and motion made me feel like the plane was about to fall apart. I held my breath. I closed my eyes. I said a silent prayer. I didn't need any sudden negativity to weigh down the aircraft just when it appeared to be struggling to fly. As always, prayer worked. The plane lifted off the ground. We were finally on our way to Germany. As we sailed above the clouds, my mind drifted back to memories of the past. We were bused far into the country away from the rest of our white friends on post when I attended my first school in the fifth grade in Georgia. I pondered the circumstances that caused me to pummel a kid to the ground in my physical ed class when I was in Texas in the sixth grade. Was I too sensitive? Was I unable to hide my feelings? Was I frustrated with moving around so many times and not having any permanent friends? I didn't know what it was, but I knew I'd get in trouble if I did something like that again. I recall being escorted to a military police compound and questioned extensively about vandalism that was discovered in our neighborhood. My dad and his reputation saved me from the clutches of those false accusations. But I worried that my dad would not always be there to protect me. It was a secret fear I held and kept to myself. We were dependents, and our futures depended upon the continued good fortune of our military dad. I tried to block out negative thoughts. I had survived more than one perilous situation. One rainy day in Oklahoma, I had crawled out from under an armored personnel carrier when I should have been mangled just as severely as my bicycle. Would I be that fortunate if death stalked me again? Would I be that foolish to place myself in jeopardy by riding in the rain? I hope not. I needed a fresh start, one with a clean slate. I was looking forward to getting my chance at the end of our journey to the other side of the world when we flew to Germany. That's the opening prologue for A Look Back in Time, Memoir of a Military Kid in the 50s, Volume 2. It talks about all the things that happened during our tour in the United States when we lived in a number of places: Virginia, Maryland, Georgia, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, all of those places for no longer than 3 years at a time. And now I was on my way with my family to Germany in an airplane for the very first time. It was exciting. The C-130 Hercules aircraft takeoff had been magnificent. The huge bird rose into the sky, carrying its precious cargo of military families tucked safely aboard. We were scheduled to fly for most of the night. It had been a rough few days, and we were tired. We slept despite the jolts and bumps coming from the air currents rising above the mighty Atlantic Ocean. I rested my head on the headrest and marveled at God's magnificent creation. The heavens were in plain view, transformed in the star-speckled darkness of night. I listened to the powerful engines roar as they propelled us forward. The noise drowned out all my thoughts of yesterday and replace them with the anticipation of new adventures to come. In time, I stopped holding my breath and allowed my body to adjust to the abrupt changes in altitude, which occurred throughout the night. My mind adapted gradually to the large fuselage until I felt at ease. A few hours later, my dad reached under his seat and retrieved a box loaded with military rations. He roused us and asked if we wanted something to eat. We eagerly awaited as he unwrapped the rations. He opened a few cans and handed them to us with utensils. My sister Bernadine and brother Mercer looked at the open cans of something they couldn't tell what it was and passed them over to me. I guess their stomachs were a little queasy and they didn't want to take a chance. I accepted their leftovers eagerly. As they watched, I ate my own rations and theirs. As my stomach filled, my nerves calmed. My earlier anxiety about flying waned. I gradually dozed off to sleep, aided by the hum of the engines in the background. They whirred continuously, providing the thrust needed to propel the giant plane through the sky. It would be nice to say that the flight across the ocean was without any real excitement, any real anxiety, but that wasn't true. Suddenly, my restful dream was interrupted. The plane was shaking violently. I held on to the headrest to steady myself. The portal shades had been drawn while we slept, so I couldn't tell if it was night or day. The plane veered sharply to the left, and I began to develop a queasy feeling in the pit of my stomach. We were changing course, but I didn't know why. My sister stirred beside me. She rubbed her eyes, peered at the shuttered windows. Then she turned to me and asked if I was awake. It was then I realized I had been staring at the inside of my eyelids. I was apparently too afraid to open my eyes. I grasped her hand and didn't say a word. The plane changed direction again and lunged forward. I was just about ready to fall out of my seat when a voice came over the intercom instructing us to fasten your seatbelts and prepare for a landing. Landing where, I thought? We're in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I waited for further explanation to follow. None did. I was near panic. That's when I noticed my dad open his window shade to peer into the night. I summoned the courage to follow his lead and push mine upwards just slightly. I could see a faint glimmer of light to our left. The light seemed to be suspended in the middle of nowhere. I wondered if lifeboats were already circling below to rescue us. That thought reminded me of how tight my stomach muscles had become. I prayed silently to hold myself together, no matter what came next. My siblings and the rest of my family would expect that of me. Suddenly, the plane took a giant leap and shook violently. I could feel the bottom dropping out of the fuselage. I prayed it would hold up under all the stress. I reached under the seat to search for the flotation device that the onboard instructor had told us about. I stretched out my hand just as the plane swerved and plunged towards the earth. I braced for the impending collision. The crash seemed to take forever to materialize. The aircraft rocked gently from side to side as it floated above the waves. I waited for it to hit the water. To my surprise, it never did. Instead, it dropped suddenly onto a blacktop runway. We had avoided tragedy. We landed on an island in the middle of the ocean. Our unexpected stopover was in the Azores, a set of 9 volcanic-created islands belonging to Portugal. That was my introduction to flying and my introduction to landing in the middle of the ocean in the Azores. We went from that landing to the mainland, and on the mainland, we were greeted by a gentleman who was responsible for seeing that we got to our next destination. His name was Sergeant Kaufman. Sergeant Kaufman was waiting for us as we exit the building. His physique resembled our dad's. He was a short, stocky man with broad shoulders. He had a clean-shaven face and a confident smile. His khakis were pressed, and he wore an impressive array of what we call fruit salad, a term for the assortment of Army medals on his chest. I was impressed when I recognized his sharpshooter's badge hanging smartly below the bunch, fit-shine pair of boots with a shiny-brimmed hat to match. Dad introduced our mom to Sergeant Kaufman and then rattled off each of our names and ages that he had done so many times before. The sergeant listened intently and nodded his head in acknowledgement. He directed us to follow him. Our mother checked to be sure we were all there. Then she turned and walked a half step behind my dad. We fell in line behind her as we had done so many times before. Dad followed Sergeant Kaufman to the rear of the building where a camouflaged five-seater Army vehicle waited. My brother, sisters, and I got into the back. Mom and Dad rode up front. We were surprised to see that our dad was designated as the driver. I noticed during our ride to the airport that the road signs were different from the ones in the States. This was Germany. I wondered if our dad had memorized the differences. I would soon find out. Sergeant Kaufman pulled up in front of us in his Willie, a 1950s Jeep. He leaned out of the front seat and motioned for our dad to follow him. Dad reached for the clutch and hesitated for a moment. I didn't know whether he had ever driven a vehicle like this one before. He braced himself and shifted into gear. The vehicle lurched forward and settled into a steady stride. Our trip across the country to our next destination had begun. I'd like to say that our trip to our first homestead in Germany was uneventful, that it didn't have a lot of excitement, that everything went smoothly. But as you know in life, not really the case. There's always something that you have to deal with before you get to where you're looking to go. We wound our way through the military complex. The guard cleared us at the gate and returned to his post. We were on our way. We left the security of the military base and ventured into the countryside. It was a crisp, windy morning. The overnight dew still clung to the neatly cut grass in the fields. The road stretched out ahead of us as far as we could see. Dad kept his eyes fixed on the sergeant's Jeep in front of us. My sister and I took turns spotting cows off in the distance. I noticed a strange cluster of small animals. They appeared to be cat-sized rodents crouched to the ground. Turned out they were German hedgehogs. I would have watched them longer, but we were fast approaching a small village. I didn't want to miss anything. As we entered the village, the speed limit dropped precipitously. The road narrowed and converged into tightly knitted turns carved neatly into hand-laid cobblestone streets. There were no sidewalks. So large military vehicles like ours had to be careful navigating the roadway. I saw the sergeant's Jeep wind its way around a tight curve and disappear. Dad followed as closely as he could. As Dad rounded the bend, a young woman appeared. She had a little girl walking by her side. The Jeep passed them and continued. Dad slowed our vehicle in preparation for passing, too. He couldn't have anticipated what would happen next. The little girl dropped her mother's hand, turned, and darted out into the road. Dad jammed on the brakes, and the vehicle came to an abrupt halt. The girl looked up and collided with the front of our vehicle. The little girl ran into our vehicle. I watched, stunned, as she slid under the front bumper and fell to the ground. Her mother screamed in shock. Meine Kind, my child, I would learn later in German. Dad's head snapped back suddenly. He sat frozen as he tried to make sense of the scene unfolding in front of him. A little girl had run into the street. She had run into our vehicle, bumped her head, and fallen to the pavement. She didn't move. The girl's mother was uttering something that sounded unintelligible then. I learned later that her hysterical outburst was a fervent apology for the child's actions. Our dad looked up to see Sergeant Kaufman, who had stopped his vehicle and came to assist us. The sergeant said something in German to the distraught mother. She reacted by nodding her head. Then she kneeled, placed her daughter's head into her lap, and began to speak softly to her. The little girl reached up to grab her mother around the neck, and the crowd, which had formed, reacted with cheers and a happy sigh of relief. Sergeant Kaufman leaned over, whispered something in my dad's ear. My dad shook his head to let him know that he understood. Sergeant Kaufman made certain that everything was okay. And then we watched with relief as the little girl and her mother walked back to the side of the street, and all of the townspeople surrounded them and cheered. Thank God, my mom said, thank God for sparing the life of that mother's child. My dad started the engine, put the vehicle in gear, and closed the distance between us and Sergeant Kaufman, who had already gotten into his vehicle and begun. We sat silently, not wanting to recall what had just happened. We knew we had been saved by divine intervention. I had heard stories of horrible tragedies befell Negroes who found themselves in life and death situations. I was aware of the dire consequences of those who found themselves confronted by an angry mob. I knew that a simple explanation was often inadequate to persuade an angry mob to spare your life. I thank God for saving us from such a catastrophe. And I vowed to learn to speak German. I wanted to be able to plead for justice for my family if such an incident ever occurred again. That was our introduction to traveling in Germany. It was an unfortunate accident, but I really learned something. And I was very determined to learn to speak German, which I did. It helped me focus in my classes, and I was glad that I did. When we got to our new location, our mom was very quick to take control. We had chores to do. We had to set up our rooms, and we had to make certain that all of the bags and everything were brought in. And we had a very long day, and thankfully everybody slept well. I was anxious. I wanted to meet new friends, and so I could hardly wait for the next day to come where I could go outside and meet the locals. At breakfast, I cleared my plate and asked my mother if I could go outside. To my surprise, my mother told me that I could go, but she expected me to be back in a short while to help unpack. I didn't hesitate. Instead, I grabbed my jacket, opened the door, dashed into the stairwell, flew down the steps, and headed straight for the quadrangle separating our buildings. We lived in a building, three stories. We were on the third story. There were a number of families, military families like ourselves, in the building. We were in a quadrangle with buildings across from us and a large open area with concrete and some planted trees. The early morning light blinded me as I exited the building. I stopped abruptly and shielded my eyes. I needed to get my bearings. The cool breeze whipped me in the face. I pulled my jacket collar up around my neck. The mist from the nearby pond rose slowly into the air, creating a silver curtain across the landscape. Our buildings were near a number of large ponds. These ponds were used to cultivate carp, which was a German fish delicacy. In the winter, these ponds froze over and the local kids would ice skate on them. My body felt invigorated from the cool wind. I prayed for this new experience to last. My quiet interlude was cut short. I could sense someone else's presence in the area. I was aware of them even before their footsteps reached my ears. In the distance, I saw a tall, thin silhouette of a boy. His hair stood a full 3 inches atop his forehead. In the bright rays of the morning sun, his profile resembled a shiny black top hat with no brim. His eyes were fixed in a penetrating stare. He was looking at me. He seemed to be sizing me up. He was wearing black jeans, a blue and white checkered shirt, and a pair of high-top Keds, fancy shoes. He approached cautiously. I could see his piercing eyes. They revealed a veiled curiosity to match his disarming smile. As he drew closer, I extended my hand in a friendly gesture to say hello. He paused, looked straight at me, and grasped my hand in a firm grip. I could feel my knuckles pop as he applied the force. I winced. His grip eased. He continued to smile. I'm George, George Crosby. What's your name? I tried not to flinch, but the pain in my hand was hurting me. I asked you what's your name, George repeated. Bernard Nathaniel Lee Jr., I said. The words spilled out like a rush from a broken water fountain. I could see that George was taking his time sizing me up. Then he spoke. I live in that second building from the corner, George said. He pointed to his building. I nodded my head. He unloosed my hand. I was relieved to have it back. I live right there, I responded, pointing to my building. We're on the third floor. With those few words, we began a rapid chain of questioning. This routine is so familiar to military brats that anyone listening who's a military brat knows exactly what I'm talking about. You go back and forth in rapid succession, each one trying to gain an additional piece of information as quickly as you can. Why? Because you want to know this new person that you've met. Because for the next few years, they may be the only friend that you'll make. George's aunt was a soft-spoken woman. She had kind eyes and a friendly, welcoming smile. His brother's name was Riley. Riley was a man of few words. When he did talk, his words barged across the room and penetrated deeply. George was the brother of a career Army veteran. And he had come to Germany with his brother and his aunt. George was a seasoned military brat. He had traveled throughout the United States. They had moved at least 4 times since elementary school. He had arrived on this tour in Germany 8 months earlier. I could tell he had developed a rich background in different cultures by the way he talked about all his travels. I could tell he had also cultivated a few holes in math, science, and other academic areas. He complained that it was hard to keep up with his schoolwork moving so frequently. That's a complaint that you won't hear often from military brats, but that's a reality. If you move as we did from Georgia to Texas, and then 6 months later from Texas to Oklahoma, and then a few weeks later from Oklahoma across the pond to Germany, then you can see what I mean about maybe cultivating a few holes in your education because of moves. We might have talked for another hour if we hadn't been interrupted by a curious-looking stranger. He emerged out of the shadow of the late morning sun. His blue eyes sparkled when he spotted us. He was wearing brown lederhosen, those are German shorts, and a white linen shirt. George smirked. I tried not to stare. The stranger paused to take us in. He realized we were looking in his direction. That was his cue. He strode casually towards us. I could tell he intended to interrupt our conversation. I wondered if George, what George would do. I didn't have to wonder very long. The new kid closed in on us. He was tall. As he approached, he uttered something unintelligible. I saw George step back abruptly to let him pass. The stranger continued. George cocked his head to one side to get a better look. The stranger stopped in front of me and stood there with his hands at his side. I could tell this scene had been played out before. The tension between the stranger and my new friend was noticeable. The stranger eyed George over his left shoulder and stretched his right hand out to me. I hesitated, then slowly raised my hand to accept his invitation. My name is Werner Don Gottwald. I live in the building next to yours, he said. George eased a bit as Werner and I shook hands. It was a weak, slightly limp shake, nothing compared to the vice grip handshake George had laid on me. If Deutschland had a favorite country model, he would have looked like Werner. His hair was blonde with slight amber tones. The fine golden strands formed a shiny crescent moon atop his head. The locks rose upward, flared outward, and then fell lazily across his shoulders. I was sure he towered above all the other kids like a tall Bavarian statue. Hi, Werner, I said. My name is Bernard, and this is George, George Crosby. I expected a smile from George when I mentioned his name, but I didn't see one. Werner turned and extended his hand to George. I knew immediately that was a mistake. George took Warner's hand in his classic firm grip and squeezed. Werner did not wince or back away. He didn't seem surprised or intimidated. George stared at him, and Werner stared back. Then George loosened his grip and said, "Very nice to meet you, Werner." I could tell he was joking. I could also tell these two guys would face each other often, and the outcome would be no surprise to either of them. Finally, the tall kid spoke, and things became a bit clearer. He revealed he was an Army brat, too. He was the son of a German mother who married an American soldier in the United States Army. He seemed to be in awe of his stepfather. He told us his stepfather came from a Midwestern town in Colorado. He even offered to show us his stepfather's cowboy hat. George smiled at that friendly gesture, and the conversation continued as we probed this new kid for more information. We must have talked for most of the rest of the day. I surmised that Werner probably had his mother's smile and his stepfather's laid-back Western demeanor. I was right about his mother's smile. To say this new kid was a curious fellow would be to understate the obvious. He pumped George and me for all stateside information he could get. When we finished telling him everything we knew, he took off on a tirade about American baseball. Now, here I have to pause because I have to tell you something that really took me by surprise. I guess as Americans, we take things for granted. We don't always understand how much people outside our country know about us, want to know about us, how much they admire us, would like to be like us. And therefore, how very hard they try to get all the information they can that's about our country, America. Werner had memorized a book, a baseball book, a baseball book of statistics about all the World Series, all the championships, all the batting champions, all the pitching champions. And he rattled the statistics off from the top of his head. We looked in amazement. I realized then, if he was that interested in knowing about a country that he had never visited before, I would take the same amount of interest in his country, and I would learn as much about Germany as I could. So that was my introduction to friends and my introduction to meeting the locals. We had a really nice subdivision there. There were 7 or 8 homes. And when I say homes, these are buildings with 3 stories. And the kids were all military brats, as myself, brat being an endearing term for a military kid. And we shared one thing in common that I realized was something new for me. We were able to see Germans working and working around our complex daily. And the curiosity that we shared was satisfied one day when we were able to walk up and take a seat and meet a couple of fellas who were there working on the buildings. They were sitting in a circle, 3 fellas. They were opening their lunch boxes, and in this case, they had some sausages. They had some fruit. They had some pumpernickel bread that they were carving up into pieces. And when they saw us looking at them, they motioned for us to come over. I noticed, and so did Werner and George notice, that they had wine. And so we didn't hesitate to come over as fast as we could. When we got to the place where they were sitting under a tree, across from them, and they shared their lunch with us. We were very grateful for their hospitality, and we told them so. They nodded their head, a little bit of English that I think they could understand. Werner, being able to speak German, was able to talk directly to them, and he thanked them for both of us. We ate sandwiches with cheese and sausage, and then they passed around the wine. Werner was waiting for white wine. He didn't like the red. George took a swig of the red, and so did I. When they passed around the other bottle that they had, white wine, Werner took a big swig of white wine, and so did I. Well, this went on for a few minutes until I heard my sister call me from around the side of the building. Realizing that she would tell my mom if she found me drinking with the help, I ran as fast as I could to cut her off. I got to the corner of the building and asked her very promptly, what do you want? She says, it's time to come home. What were you doing? I gave her some made-up story about just spending some time with my friends, and she told me, she said that she hoped I was staying out of trouble. Well, before I could give her an answer to that, I took a half step forward and fell flat on my face. I did not realize the impact that drinking wine at midday in the heat of the sun would have. My sister looked like she was going to laugh, and then she jumped back in surprise. I think she realized what this could mean for us. If, as a military kid, you got into trouble, it reflected badly on your military parent. In fact, if you got into serious trouble, your military parent could find the repercussions were severe as well. It could be as severe as losing a stripe. And that meant a loss in prestige, a loss in advancement, and a loss in pay. So my sister very quickly reacted to what had occurred. She helped me get to my feet. She looked around the building to make sure nobody else had seen me fall. And then a lady came out of the building walking toward the other side of the quadrangle, and so we hid around the corner until she passed. Then my sister spirited me along the edge of the building into our stairwell, up three flights of stairs that were really hard to take in my state. She opened the door. Luckily, my mom had gone shopping with the kids to the post exchange. She took me back to my room. I fell flopped out on my bed. She closed the door and took a seat in the chair up near the front of the hall. She took out her knitting and began crocheting, which she did often. And she stood guard there for me the rest of the afternoon. When my mother came home, she distracted her. They went into the kitchen to cook dinner, and I was allowed all the time I needed to recover from an incident that could have been very, very bad, could have gone very, very badly for me. That was an introduction to the help. I got an introduction to working. You know, I was just a teenager going into the eighth grade, and I needed a job, and I needed new clothes for school, maybe a new pair of shoes. And after talking to my parents about it and talking to my friends, we agreed, my friends and I, that we would go looking, and that the first person to find a job opening would come back and tell the others so that we could apply. I had an idea that I might get a lead, so I went on post to the day room, where usually guys are there playing pool, playing ping pong, or just hanging out. In this particular time, there was nobody there except one fellow, which I knew. He was a pool shark. I knew better than to play him, especially for money. But I asked him if he knew where I might find the job. And he responded, you know, you might find something over at the bowling alley. I took his word on that, and I went over to the bowling alley to see what I could find. The bowling alley was on the main post. It was a place where my parents had gone to bowl in this fall in a bowling league. So I was somewhat familiar with it. I knew that the young kids there, young meaning in their teens, were occasionally allowed to set the pins in the alley. And I thought maybe I could get a job doing that. So I walked up to the desk and encountered a fellow who was guarding it, and very boldly asked him if I could speak with the manager. Well, this fellow who was responsible for getting people their shoes and making sure that all the lanes were working as they should, took affront to me wanting to speak with his boss. And so he tried to ignore me. I wasn't going to be ignored, so I asked again. When he finally paid attention, and I knew he was listening, he wanted to know, why do you want to talk to my boss? That's when I said, I have a proposition for him. Well, the word proposition sounded like money could be at the other end of it, so he didn't want to hold that up. So he went around the corner to get his boss so I could talk with him. A short, stocky man appeared in the doorway to the office. His plump, round face was adorned with pale, white, receding hairline. He wore suspenders with a green and yellow shirt tucked into his brown corduroy trousers. He looked fashionable enough with a pair of bowling shoes on his feet. When he spotted me, he broke into a big, broad smile. "You're Sergeant Lee's son, aren't you?" he declared. He didn't wait for an answer before extending his arm to shake my hand. I placed my small hand in his, and my fingers were nearly crushed when he squeezed it. I thought he and George would enjoy meeting each other. "My name was Alfonso, but you could call me Mr. Al," he explained. I thanked him for the introduction. I wondered how he knew my dad. He asked me if Mom and Dad were going to bowl in the Winter League. Then I knew. "Your dad always has a good time when he bowls," he said. "The fellows tell me he's a generous tipper." "So what can I do for you?" Mr. Al asked. His smile grew even wider. I didn't waste any time getting to the point. "I need to find a job. I need something to help pay for my school clothes," I blurted out. I didn't mean to sound desperate, but I was. "Have you ever set pins?" Mr. Al asked me. "No, sir," I replied. That was the truth. I quickly followed with, "But if you give me a chance, sir, I'm willing to learn." That answer seemed to satisfy him. "What's your name, son?" Mr. Al asked me. "Bernard, sir," I answered. "What's your shoe size, Bernard?" Mr. Al inquired. I told him my shoe size, and he went to get me a pair of 9 1/2. As you might expect, he didn't come back with 9 1/2. He came back with a pair of 10s, but they fit just fine. And then Mr. Al said, "Follow him." We walked back between the lanes and dropped back into the well in the back of the alley. Mr. Al reached over and pulled down a rack of bowling pins, and he set the rack on the floor, and then he released the lever, and the pins set up nice and straight. So Mr. Al looked at me, and he said, "Now here's what you're going to do. You're going to set those pins so I can see if you'll do for my job." Well, I thought that that meant that all I had to do was pull down a rack and the pins would set up like they did for Mr. Al. But that wasn't the case. He knocked over the pins and then he pointed to them and asked for me to rack them up. Well, I picked up a couple and began shelving them into the rack. I realized after a couple of pins fell on my feet that it's better if you grip one with each hand and maybe between your fingers another one tightly, and then you can pick up 2 or 3 at a time. I filled the rack, reached up to pull it down, yanked on it, and it didn't budge. Mr. Al looked at me curiously, but he didn't offer any advice. I tipped on my tiptoes. I put all I had into it, mustered up, and yanked down hard. And the rack gradually lowered. The pins touched the floor. And then as I let go of the rack, they wobbled, but they stood firm. Mr. Al smiled. He said, "Okay, that's pretty good. Now what are you going to do?" Well, I had never been in a well before setting up pins, so I just stood there and looked at him. Mr. Al said, "I think you better get out of the way. You don't want to be there when a ball comes flying down the alley." Well, my lesson went on for another half an hour that day. Mr. Al showed me how to set the pins. He showed me how to hop from one area to another area to set two rows of pins at a time. And later, when I went back, I forgot to tell my friends, but Mr. Al had offered me a job. At school, at the beginning of the week, I was cornered by Warner and George. They wanted to know why I'd been avoiding them. I said that I hadn't been avoiding them, but actually in my head, maybe I had. And then George popped the question, so when were you going to tell us about the job you got at the bowling alley? Oh, I intended to tell you guys about that, I said. George said, yeah, right. I said, look, I met Mr. Al, and I did ask him about a job for you two. I'll let you know what he says. Warner looked at me curiously. So did George. Actually, the two of them came later that week, and Mr. Al gave both of them a job as well as myself. We were setting pins one night for a group, a rowdy group. These were American GIs. They were having a good night at the end of the week, and they were drinking, maybe a little too much. And one guy had gotten, you know, really rowdy and really, I guess, a little bit agitated. So he threw a ball down the lane, and it rolled into the gutter. George jumped into the well, picked the ball up, and rolled it back. But before he could get from the well, the guy threw another ball down the alley. It hit a bunch of pins, and George was able to move his legs just in time not to be nipped by the ball or a pin. I could tell he was really, really angry about what happened. He looked like he was going to go running up there to ball the guy out. I knew that wasn't going to go well for him or for the other two of us. George picked up the pins, racked the rack, sent the second ball back, put all the pins in the rack, and set the rack down. The guy became irate. For some reason, he claimed that he deserved to have another ball and another shot at the pins, and that the pin setter had messed up his game. Well, he made so much noise that Mr. Al came out of the office. George couldn't take it. George jumped up out of the well and started down the other lane on the other side. Warner and I were right behind him. When we got to the front, Mr. Al asked me, what's going on? I explained to him that the guy had been a little rowdy, and that he had thrown a gutter ball, and that George had picked up the ball and thrown it back, but before he could get out of the well, the guy had thrown another ball, and the pins had almost hit George. And then when George racked the rack for the next guy to take his turn, this guy complained. I'll see what I can do, Mr. Al said. Do you guys think you can handle this? The unspoken question was, do you think you can handle these guys that have had a few? Because that's your job. I knew this was going to be a test, so I was determined not to fail at it. I looked and I saw the guys looking at us, so I called Warner and George, myself, together, and I said, look, guys, don't look over there, but we're going to turn and walk toward the door like we're leaving, and let's see what happens. And that's what we did. As we turned to walk toward the door, the manager realized that without pin setters, his night was done. So he walked over to the felt to the guys, talked to them quietly, got both teams to agree that they would not do anything like the guy had done by throwing two balls down at once. And then he came over and asked us, is everything okay? I said, sure. And we went back to the back of the bowling alley. Here's what happened next. George set up the pins for the guy who was on his next to last frame in the game, and then he took the middle pin out and set the pins down. When the guy threw his ball, it went right into the pocket in what should have been a strike for sure. And then the pattern was left in the pins because of the missing pin. The guy was frantic. He didn't know what he was going to do. He did not get his spare. He did not close strongly. I asked George later, did he do it deliberately? He claimed it was Warner's idea. We all had a great laugh as we walked home. I hope you've enjoyed the stories that I've shared with you of a look back in the time, memoir of a military kid in the 50s. You can get a copy of this book by going to my website at www.BernardLeeJr.com. B as in Bravo, E as in Echo, RNARDLEEJR.com.
I thoroughly enjoyed what I heard, and from the moment you were looking on the other side of your eyelids to landing in the volcanic Portuguese area, just going forward to all of these experiences that you have shared, it is truly, truly like being there. I must commend you. You are a phenomenal orator. I want to shout out Michelle Berard, who introduced us, and she is the host of Somewhere in the Middle. She said you were phenomenal and that your story was as well, and I would agree. So this has been another exciting look back in time with Bernard Lee Jr. And Bernard, thank you so very much. We are looking forward to part 3, August 2nd. Same time, same Tribe Family Channel. Be blessed.
Thank you, Beverly.
Done.
Everybody thinks we're all but a mother. Who are they to judge us? Mother, mother, simply call us sweet where I am. Oh, but a mother. Ooh.